Bonjour, bienvenue to Film Weekly with Jason Solomons, and welcome to our second Cannes Film Festival special. Welcome indeed aboard the Isle of Man, a boat here in the harbour at the Cannes Film Festival. You can hear the boats chugging away in the background, the wind whipping up, and the cocktail tunes of parties on boats adjacent to us are just kicking off. This week on the show, we'll be talking The Body Beautiful with actor, director and Bond villain Mathieu Amalric.
But it's also for women who doesn't have breasts. It's just anybody, any body, let's say.
I meet a trio of the finest British actors, Jim Broadbent, Ruth Sheen and Leslie Manville, to discuss their roles in Mike Leigh's Another Year.
And I hadn't worked with Ruth, but the fact that we've all worked with Mike, there's a sort of a joint experience, a shared experience in the past.
Chinese director Wang Xiaoshuai sings the blues about his film Chongqing Blues.
Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
And the Lennon and McCartney of film criticism, Zan Brooks and I, I'm the Lennon, of course, will be rounding up the festival so far, taking a punt on who's in the running for the big one, the 2010 Palme d'Or. Yes, it's as chilled as a bottle of rosé. It's Film Weekly. Ah, the familiar strains of Camille Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals and the Aquarium. Anyone who's been to the festival will know that that piece of music is the introduction to all the festival screenings, so it strikes hope into the heart of every critic and filmmaker. It's the sort of music that makes you tingle with excitement. Are we about to witness genius or disaster? Well, Mike Leigh has been in competition 4 times, so he knows the vicissitudes of that piece of music. He's back in Cannes with his new film Another Year, having triumphed in 1996, taking the Palme d'Or for Secrets and Lies. Will Another Year be as good as that one? It's a more measured affair, certainly, telling the story of Tom and Jerry, a contented couple who, close to retirement, offer their home and food to friends whose lives are not as rosy as theirs, chiefly to Jerry's work colleague Mary, whose growing infatuation with their son and the bottle proves to be a step too far for the stoic couple. Mary is played by Lee favourite Leslie Manville, Tom by Jim Broadbent and Jerry by Ruth Sheen. All of them part of the Mike Leigh family, so I was myself delighted to be welcomed into the bosom of this fine trio of thespians. I'm here at the Moët and Chandon Beach, where it doesn't get more glamorous than this, and the sea is encroaching on us in a quite stormy can. But I am joined by the cast of Mike Leigh's brilliant film Another Year, Leslie Manville, Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen. Congratulations on your performance, and bienvenue, I can.
Thank you. And can I just correct you? I know somebody who knows Mr. Chandon, and apparently it is Moët.
Do you know what? I nearly corrected and I thought, well, this lot aren't going to know that.
No. Yeah, you see, you think we're all plebs, and we're not.
She's like that. She'll just pick you up on anything.
She's very, very difficult to work with.
But it is, I mean, I got you all together because, you know, you do have such a great relationship on the screen. And, you know, you create the kind of family and the family friends in the film. Does it get like that after working so long together? Do you sort of feel like, I mean, you're all part of the Mike Leigh family anyway. Does that make it easier to pick up? Or is it in a way harder because you have to create new vibes for each film?
Yeah, I think it's sort of harder because, I mean, I've worked with Leslie before. But in a funny sort of way, because there's spaces in between, you just sort of forget about what you've done before.
Yeah,
and
you do.
Because, I mean, this is our third one, isn't it,
yeah,
really, where we've actually worked together. And
yeah.
The first one was High Hopes, where she was that awful woman, Booth Brain.
I think you were pretty awful too.
Yeah, but I think it does, I mean, I've worked with Leslie a couple of times, and I hadn't worked with Ruth, but the fact that we've all worked with Mike, there's a sort of a joint experience, a shared experience in the past, so we're very quickly onto the same wavelength when we started working together. And I like working with people I've worked with before, and it was very much as if I'd worked with Ruth before.
Leslie, tell me about Mary and how you created her and what you started with to the kind of complex and sad character that you sort of end up with.
Well, I mean, as ever with Mike, you do start with nothing. So he didn't come to me and say, right, I want you to play this, lonely lonely woman who drinks too much. And, you know, you start with an absolute blank canvas, and then over the months, and it is months, of rehearsals, you create a character very slowly with Mike on a one-to-one basis, and that's what Jim did and that's what Ruth did. And then at a certain point, he'll start to bring characters together to make that the cocktail of relationships work, and so it sort of goes on, but it's slow, and eventually you'll start to do some improvisations, and then finally out of all those improvisations he'll distill a story, and then you film it. But there's a bit of a myth that you sort of just make it up on film as you go along, but you don't. No, I mean, once we film it, it's we know what we're saying, and in that sense it's pretty much like making a regular film. Mm. But it's just the process to get to that point has been so sort of collaborative.
What about the first sort of dinner party that you have when Tom and Jerry, Ruth and Jim, invite Mary around for dinner, and she gets, you know, hopelessly drunk and kind of, you know, spills out her guts. Was there I know Mike likes to kind of actually sort of recreate that scene so that there's a freshness. Was there a night when you thought, oh, well, I mean, we've got to invite Mary around for dinner? And there was a real kind of, let's get Leslie or stroke Mary around, and what's she going to do?
We did improvise that scene for quite a long period of time. Mm. Where Mary came round and got drunk, and we probably did quite a few hours.
You sort of do it in real time, don't you? I mean, yeah. So we did have a dinner that there was real food, yeah, and we had a dinner, and it lasted many hours.
Who cooked?
Tom and Jerry.
Tom? Maybe Jerry cooked that one, but I mean, certainly the first one you see, Tom. First scene where you see Tom making the arrabbiata, he's cooked it.
Did you actually cook it?
Absolutely, yes. Cooked it in real time, and it tastes exactly like the arrabbiata I cook at home, coincidentally.
Funny that.
Yeah. And it suddenly become. I was talking to Eddie Marson, of course, who played it. It was in Mike's having a look in Virage, and there's a film at the moment. He plays a sort of kidnapper, and at the start he kind of does all this kind of banging and stuff, and does a lot of DIY and makes it. And he said, "I'm useless in real life. It's only when I got into character that I could actually do it." Just what if you become better cooks when you're in character?
No, Tom is exactly as good a cook as I am. It's the only thing we have in common.
Well, Mary's a terrible cook, of course.
Mary never cooks. Her fridge has got a bottle of vodka and a Kit Kat in it.
And the gardening as well, is that something you do normally? Or you suddenly become a green fingered?
You've had an allotment, haven't you?
Yeah, I used to have an allotment, but yeah. I just grow vegetables in my back garden now. So,
do a bit of gardening. So I'm at home with a spade. Yeah. But Tom is a better gardener than I am.
that kind of married couple is quite rare in Mike's work. I mean, you played a married couple in Life is Sweet, but they were slightly more sort of at war. Although they were quite loving.
Yeah, I was thinking that just now. They were quite a happy couple as well, really, considering. Topsy Turvy, we played a married couple who weren't perhaps so quite so
maybe
happy.
You think they were happy.
No, I said they weren't quite so happy.
No, they weren't.
You must listen.
It was all suppressed, though, wasn't it? Victorian suppression. Yes.
He was always on the phone in Topsy Turvy, shouting into his earpiece.
Yes, it is, but they are a happy couple, and there seems to be a degree of surprise about seeing a happy couple on the screen. But I think it is. Because obviously conflict is more dramatic.
Yeah.
But I think if we look around our lives, we see a lot of happy couples. And I think they're more common than cinema would have us believe.
Yes. Is it apparent when you say, you know, you've done Topsy Turvy and you two did All or Nothing together? And I was sort of thinking about where Another Year is in Mike's work, what sort of piece it is.
I have a feeling, in a sense, because Mike said this, that sometimes it's not like you're making the same film over again, but I almost feel like that this is an amalgamation of all the films he's made, because you've got themes in this which to me are a replica of some of the other films, like the couples, you know, the laying in bed in a funny sort of way. If you look at all the films, you know, High Hopes,
Life is Sweet,
you have a scene where the couple are actually laying in bed having a cuddle, and you know, I just think they reverberate. I do think that there's an element of these films. And in this, I feel like it's got lots of the other films, but all in one film. So, and you know, as a universal theme of life. So.
Yeah, you don't see it many often in films. When people in bed, they're normally sex scenes and stuff. Yeah. But Mike Lee films, they're kind of BBC sitcom. You know, that's the Terry and June used to go in bed.
And why is he going to bed? Yes.
But I've been to bed with Phil Davis in a few Mike Lee films. And he always keeps his socks on. He's terrible.
Yeah, and radio, you did.
Went to bed with him on the radio as well.
I bet you thought Phil Davis was being lined up for you in this one, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Well, married have anybody, basically.
Ruth Sheen, Jim Broadbent, Leslie Manville, congratulations. And thanks so much for joining us here in Moët en Chandon Villa here in Cannes. Now the sea is encroaching. We must run away or we're going to get swept away. Congratulations, guys.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
We move now from the ever-present soft lapping of the Mediterranean Sea here on the Côte d'Azur to the more troubled seas of China. Director Wang Xiaoshuai's film Chongqing Blues tells of a sea captain, Lin, who returns from the high seas of China to try and find out why his son, Lin Bo, has been murdered by the police. The film turns into both a murder mystery and an exploration of contemporary China. This year's festival has a strong Asian presence, with no fewer than 5 films from that continent in competition, so I was delighted to track down one of the finest filmmakers from that continent, Wang, to discuss his film, Chongqing Blues. I'm with Wang Xiaoshin, director of the beautiful Chongqing Blues, a film which I fell in love with from the first shot. You know, a cable car, people, the buildings of China. It says everything in one shot about the tensions of your film. Was that the idea to say very quickly what your film was going to be about?
Yes, I wanted on purpose to make people feel that this cable car crosses the river and starts from the sky into the big city. Because even for Chinese people, Chongqing is a very special place, and it's a miracle in the middle of the west part of China, where usually this region is quite backward. So I wanted to show to people this shock that there's in this place something equivalent to Hong Kong to New York.
I think people are surprised, but not from you, because your films that have been successful here in the West and in Cannes, Beijing Bicycle and Shanghai Dreams, is this a deliberate, you know, each film you do is a sort of a song to a different city in China? Is that a deliberate one? You keep going around touring your country.
It's a pure coincidence, because in Chinese the 3 films have different titles, and it's only a pure coincidence that in English it's the sequence of big cities.
So we can always trust us English to make it easier for you. But there is a music to this one in particular. Is it the blues that is the same in Chinese? Does that have the same significance as the blues music does in English?
For me, the word blues is not a music blues, but rather the melancholy, the sadness, this gloomy side. And I use very little music in my films, because I don't want to disrupt this kind of feelings that people can have or react to what they see on the screen.
In Shanghai Dreams, there was a wonderful scene of disco, early discos from the 70s, and in this film you go into a nightclub, which is very difficult to make shoot in a nightclub, and you do it very well. There's two scenes there, and makes me think that you like to go dancing.
Actually, I don't go dancing anymore. I do go to nightclubs to meet friends or to sing songs, because now it's the trend of entertainment in China. And actually, whenever there's entertainment, China picks up very quickly, just like in Shanghai Dreams. You see right at the beginning, when the society is quite closed, they already accepted the dancing and this music.
Can you sing a song? Live karaoke here on Film Weekly.
Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Oh, xie xie. Thank you very much indeed. That's live music here on Film Weekly at The Guardian. Thank you so much. Lovely. I really enjoyed your film. It was touching and sad and exciting at the same time. So, Wang Xiaoshai, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The sun is setting over the old town, and I'm joined by Zan Brooks aboard the Isle of Man yacht on my bench with a glass of rosé to mull over the offerings in this year's Cannes competition. The 63rd Cannes, the 47th Palme d'Or will be awarded on Sunday night. Zan, do we have any idea where it's going to go?
I'm interested, this is the Isle of Man yacht. I was assuming this was yours, Jason.
Well, you know me.
You've got photos of you and your family all around.
those are just... rumbled.
Anyway, as to the winner of the Palme d'Or, I think the general feeling is that it's down to maybe two films at the moment. There's still a couple of films yet to screen. But in terms of critical response, it seems as though it's torn between the Mike Leigh film Another Year and the Xavier Beauvoir film of Men and Gods. Those seem to be the ones that have excited people the most.
In the little Screen International table, which seems to be the sort of bellwether of what's going on. I suppose everyone who arrives in Cannes does. They turn to the back of Screen International and look at this kind of assembled critics and their views. I mean, those two are sort of way out in front. I mean, they are the sort of Cohen Ovette. You know, the rest are trailing behind. Let's look at the Mike Leigh, because it is a British offering. And it was, everyone said it was going to be a bad year for the Brits in Cannes, but suddenly Mike Leigh's leading the way. Ken Loach caused a stir. We'll talk about that one later, when it sort of arrived unheralded and unannounced and didn't get in any of the pre-printed material. So late was it, so fresh it arrived. I saw it this morning in the Palais, and the print had only arrived just about an hour before I did.
He's a weird, unlikely showman, isn't he, Ken Loach? Everything about him is, no, I don't go in for any of that showbiz. But he's like the kind of the grand dame arriving late at the ball.
He is, absolutely. And he wasn't even here yet for that one. But Mike Leigh was here, and kind of significantly, he was back in competition for the first time in about 8 years. I mean, he hadn't been here, and famously had gone to Venice with Vera Drake after being snubbed by Cannes, and he thought he said he'd never come back. Well, anyway, they've soldered relationships, and they've let his latest film, Another Year, back in. And it seems to me that this is a film that has impressed the world with its performances.
It's a beautifully played film, isn't it? I mean, famously, Mike Leigh works in this very unorthodox way, where he assembles his actors and then builds a script from rehearsal. And it must be a very odd process to be a part of, because presumably they all come in on totally equal footing, and then some take centre stage and some are kind of gently ushered off to the wings. So you've got Imelda Staunton cropping up in the first scene, who's then never seen again, and you've got Phil Davis, another Mike Leigh regular, who's in maybe two scenes.
Plus it was one of Jim Broadbent's old mates, Ken, beautifully played by Peter White, I have to say, as a kind of smoking, gambling kind of alcoholic.
He's got a T-shirt saying, less thinking, more drinking, yes. Which is never a good sign on a middle-aged man,
is it? It's not good look, especially when the contours of your belly are kind of make it hard to read what's actually on the T-shirt. They kind of go through life together. They go from spring, summer, autumn to winter. I was pleased that it doesn't say fall for the autumn bit, just to please the American audience. But
It might do.
It's a cyclical film, which is kind of unusual for Mike Leigh. Normally they sort of go through stages, but there's always a linear. This is the first cyclical kind of thing I've seen.
Well, it's been compared to Ozu, this film, by Mark Cousins, in fact, on the Quasette.
Well, quel surprise.
But I can kind of see it, and I think Leigh has always made no bones about the fact that he admires Ozu, and it has that same contemplative quality that the Ozu's films have. It's a sort of elegiac film, really. It is about the kind of the pains and the pleasures of growing old and where you are at in your life when you hit that wall, really, where your job stops and you need to sort of just work out who you're with and what you're doing. If I had any reservation with it at all, it's that it's Mike Leigh very much within his comfort zone. And maybe that's no bad thing. I mean, it's possibly pound for pound the strongest and the most satisfying film in the competition. But having said that, it didn't shock me. It didn't take me by surprise.
If you'd never seen a Mike Leigh movie and you went to see this, what would you think of
Mike Leigh? I think he was a genius, and I think that this film was a masterpiece and that it should win the Palme d'Or.
Well, there you go. That's not bad if you're an ingenue. But if you'd seen Topsy Turvy and Secrets and Lies and maybe Naked, what would you think? Where would it stand?
You'd say this would be within the top five, I think.
Top five, Mike Leigh. That's not a bad offering for Cannes another year. So hot favourite at the moment, we think, for the Palme d'Or. And I kind of agreed with you. And I certainly wouldn't be embarrassed coming back from Cannes and sort of saying, well, another year won the Mike Leigh. I still would think that that was a fairly weak year in which a kind of not the best Mike Leigh film he's ever made wins the Palme d'Or. Let's look at some of the other contenders, though, and what people are saying is good. Juliette Binoche, I think, must be a contender for Best Actress for her performance, and it really is a performance. At no point does she let you forget that she's acting her little chaussettes off. In Abbas Kiarostami's Certified Copy, she plays a woman in a small Tuscan village going to see a book launch by an English writer called James Miller, who's played by an opera singer called William Schimmel, who, as Juliet is a titan of world acting, he is a minnow because he's never done it before.
It has to be said he does it rather well, apart from one scene in a restaurant where he has to get cross. And I think you see the limitations of his acting in that scene. Having said that, there's this weird conceit where they're playing being a middle-class married couple. They've been married for 15 years, they're saying. They're propping up this illusion. So they're really kind of role-playing.
So can you explain this film to anyone?
Let me try a little explanation. I'm not sure if this works. It's the William Schimmel character, James Miller, is an art historian. There's a lot of talk about forgeries and copies and what's original and what's fake. They go for a drive into the countryside where they first sort of accept this misconception that they're married, and then they push it to its logical conclusions. And so they become like a bickering couple who've been married for 15 years and the spark's slightly gone out. And then they reach a resolution in that. And I think what this film is saying is that we all role play our lives, that we are all basically living a charade.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it any less real.
Yeah, that's true.
But it didn't work for you.
Well, no, I did enjoy it, and I get the idea. I mean, someone has dubbed it, as Mark Cousins has dubbed Mike Leigh the Ozu. This is Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise for people with PhDs in semiotics.
Yes, or a bit Eric Rohmer, which, of course, Richard Linklater was borrowing heavily from.
Yeah. And I was like, well, are they married? Are they not? Are they? Maybe they are. There's still a bit of mystery.
Yes, there is a bit of mystery.
That's what kept me going.
Yeah, you wonder if what they're role-playing is the end of the film, or the second half of the film, where they're pretending to be the married couple, or whether what they're role-playing is actually that they've only just met.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of, you know, it's left open.
Yeah, I thought that she was so brilliant to watch, and just doing all, she was crying, kind of doing all that high naturalistic acting kind of thing in four languages, I think, at some stage. And he was just a bit sort of, I thought, well, why did you choose him? He's not really a very good actor.
But the fact with Kiarostami is that he has a tendency not to use professional actors anyway. So maybe we've been actually making weird allowances for him with his Iranian films, and that we see these non-professional actors and we think, God, they're so good, because we don't know the language, we don't understand the nuances of their acting. Then when we see an English baritone who has never acted before in his life, you think, he's striking a few false notes there.
I thought so, and I just didn't get the point. It was like watching, in the acting stakes, it was like watching sort of Martina Navratilova take on like the British number 364 in Straight Sex, and not giving him a game, you know, six love.
Yeah, well, but I still quite like this. I found it was a provocative film. It's a very quiet film.
Yeah.
But it casts a spell, and it sort of stayed with me. And
I liked
about
its
it
ideas. I could see it sort of at the ICA quite happily. But would if that won the Palme d'Or,
it shouldn't win the Palme d'Or.
It's not a big enough movie. It's a little sketch.
Yes,
for me.
It is. Yeah.
But one I nevertheless enjoyed immensely. Now, something that came along quite late in the competition is a film called Des Hommes et des Dieux, of Men and Gods, set amongst 9 Cistercian monks in a monastery somewhere in a hilltop in the Atlas Mountains in Algeria.
That's the strapline on the poster.
Yeah, go see. Go see this film or just contemplate it.
I like this film. I think it's perhaps being a little bit overrated because I think people are just clutching at things now. We've reached that stage of the competition where you just think, just give us something really, really good.
Yeah.
And this is really good, but I'm not sure if it's really, really good. These are my criteria for judging films. Really or really, really?
Yeah. It's obviously contemplative. They do a lot of chanting, these monks. They do a lot of shall we stay, shall we go kind of thing, because they're being surrounded by Islamic terrorists who are going to sort of cut their throats for some reason, and yet they still decide to stay. And basically the story is that it's like they start to vote whether we should stay, and then some say we should go and some say we should stay, and I was like, just go already because you're going to die. And in fact, it's based on a real story, which it says at the beginning, so
devoted, aren't they? They can't just go. They're devoted to their god and their religion, and it's a film about the role that religion plays in the modern world, and particularly a violent modern world, and the clash of cultures, and it has a very, very good performance From Lambert Wilson as one of the monks who's kind of as interested in the Quran as he is in the Bible, and so has a relationship with this North African community that they're in. That's a very shaky relationship, but he's the sort of the bridge between the two worlds.
There's also a lovely performance of Michael Lonsdale, who's a great actor. He was the Bond villain in Moonraker, and now he's sort of grown old and kind of, and he was in the new wave of French film. But he's bilingual as well, as is Lambert Wilson, actually. Kind of both doing French here, but they can both do English very well. I'm not their agent, by the way, because anyone's listening, they want to kind of hire them, but they can. He's the doctor, and I thought that was kind of an interesting role because he actually sort of takes care pastorally of the community. And there was one point he sort of says, I've looked after the devil himself, I've looked after Nazis, I've looked after Islamic extremists. Should he care for the nation that's harbouring him in some way? And I thought he was a very interesting moral equivalent in the film. And there's a beautiful scene at the end which everyone's talking about.
The last scene is great.
It's not just a giveaway. They listen to Swan Lake, the dying swan from Swan Lake, while they're having a sort of meal of some sort, or they're drinking some wine, and they all start laughing and kind of bonding. And
it's a brilliantly reined in ending for a film that is based on real events. It's based on a violent act, the kidnapper murder of these Cistercian monks, that's always there in the background, and you know that it's coming, but it takes a devil of a time getting there, and then it plays out largely in the wings, and actually that kind of works, I think, and that gives it a resonance, because it's not really about the act, it's about the world that they're inhabiting and trying to make a kind of peace with.
A bigger name of world cinema in a can that contained very few, I think, is Alejandro González Iñárritu.
It's a big name in all ways.
The Mexican who given us Amores Perros and Babel in the past. He was in competition with a film called Beautiful. And I say it like that because it's spelled B-I-U-T-I-F-U-L, because that's how his daughter misspells it. Starring Javier Bardem. What was this about?
This was a big redemption song, really, set in the sort of the badder areas of Barcelona, with Javier Bardem as a sort of scam artist, con artist, criminal who's got fingers in every pie. He's a single dad, he's looking after his kids, his wife is bipolar and she's absconded.
He's also a prostitute of some sort.
I was going to gloss over that just to spare her modesty. He has a diagnosis of terminal cancer, so he comes running around Barcelona, and he's you know, when he's not peeing blood into toilet bowls, he's trying to kind of arrange his estate and look after his kids and maybe make some amends for the people that he's been exploiting, and you know, all these sort of immigrant labourers, the dealers, and the people who work in the sweatshop. That he has kind of a connection with.
There's another sort of spiritual element to it, isn't there? A more ghostly element to it, because apart from all this, that he wheels and deals with Chinese labourers and kind of Senegalese drug dealers, he can speak to dead people.
He can speak to dead people, just like the little kid in The Sixth Sense. It's an indulgent film, really. I think it's brilliantly made. I think Iñárritu is a master visual director, and he's great on set pieces. There's some superb set pieces in this, whether it's the sort of tragic moment where the sweatshop labourers die in their kind of on their mattresses in their sort of basement, or this brilliant scene where the cops run after the dealers through Barcelona city centre, and they're kind of, you know, leaping over the cars and knocking
really
all the tables out of the way.
Fine bit of filmmaking.
It's a superb bit of choreography.
Yeah, and it just made me think, why don't you just do that instead of all this soulful nonsense? Yeah. But so I hated this film, Dan. From the moment it started, I hated the sound design. I hated Javier moping along
Javier.
With his face. What if someone says, why the cara de culo? You've got a face like a smacked ass all the way through. I hated his hair. The worst thing it was here in Cannes, the film to me smacked of inauthenticity, of mauvaise foi.
I think that is true. I think it's a big, pompous, florid film.
Always what happens in Cannes is you're always in the wrong place at the wrong time. Philosophically, I've deal with this.
Just we're not at the moment.
No, right
yacht.
Now we're where we should be, and all is right with the world. But I think you deal with it by sort of saying, well, I've made my choice, I'm sticking with it. Where I am is the right place to be. However, I've just had sort of 12 days of feeling that I've never been in the right place whatsoever. Tell me about a film I missed, which people are going on about, I hope you're going to go on about and say, I've missed an absolute masterpiece, I'll never see it again, and I've missed the Palme d'Or winner, and I'm going to be in a lot of trouble.
You've certainly missed a really good film, I think. I'm not sure what anybody else is saying about this one, because I haven't really spoken to anyone about
it. Quite right.
It's called My Joy. It's a Russian film by a director called Sergei Loznitsa, who I'd never heard of before. It's about a Russian trucker who sort of trundles across the lawless rural badlands of the country.
Is it modern-day Russia?
It's modern-day Russia. It's post-Soviet Russia, where it's all fallen apart. There are weird flashbacks to World War II. That are then kind of explained later on. But really, it's like a sort of social realist odyssey, that he goes across this terrible landscape, and he meets these sort of mythic characters almost, but the mythic characters are played by, you know, a disgraced old soldier, a child prostitute, and these sort of thugs who hide out in the woods.
It sounds like I'd really like this film.
It's dark and black, and it's like a sort of bruise, but it is an astonishing film.
Sounds like a new talent has emerged visually, speaking from the stills I've seen of this film, and this filmmaker who I've never heard of. It sounds like there maybe has been a discovery here.
Certainly by me, and hopefully by the jury. I mean, if this won, I wouldn't have any problems with this winning the top
I mean,
prize.
I would, only because I've missed it. Someone who's certainly not a discovery here in Cannes is Ken Loach, a former Palme d'Or winner and a very much regular here at Cannes. He was only here last year with Looking for Eric, his film about Cantona. But I suppose he was a bit of a discovery this year when we got here to find out that he's suddenly been accepted into competition, as we mentioned earlier. His film Root Irish screened this very morning, and it's I don't think you managed to get
no,
it.
No, so tell me about Ken.
I'll tell you about Ken.
What's Ken up to?
Ken is he hasn't really dealt with the Iraq War before, which I'm sort of surprised.
I'm surprised by that.
He's dealt with
right.
Irish Civil War, Spanish Civil War, Northern Ireland in Hidden Agenda. So it's sort of that continuation of setting human stories with soldiers in the sort of wider political kind of spectrum. Here he's dealing with soldiers who've come back to Liverpool, where someone's best friend has been killed in Iraq, and then he discovers the sort of footage on a mobile phone and suspects that perhaps that the private contractors who've hired him have actually sort of done him in. I really liked it for about an hour, and I thought, God, this is brilliant. It's really going to work. And then it sort of stopped being about human drama and just kept about people telling you stuff, people walking in and going, Root Irish, what's that? Oh, that's the road between Baghdad Airport. Yeah. And it was slightly clunky in that way that Ken's scripts can be
when
they're not being
a lot of exposition, isn't there?
It lost to me any kind of connection to the human drama. There's a girlfriend that one of them's gone back to, then he starts having an affair with her, and that could have been brilliant, but in fact it's so in service to kind of Ken's political message that it stops being about that, and I'm going, that was actually the interesting part of the story, the human bit, and I know that would have been a better thing to concentrate on. So it sort of lost its way, Irish, in a kind of like an IED exploded halfway through plot-wise, and it didn't recover from that. There is a good kind of explosion at the end, and it's worth watching.
Loach won, I think, 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, with The Wind That Shakes the Barley. So presumably it's too soon for him to win again.
Well, I remember saying that about the Dardenne, when they sort of won. In fact, that was the last year I missed the Palme d'Or winner, thinking, well, the Dardennes aren't going to win again. They just do the same old thing. And, of course, they bloody won again with L'Enfant soon after Rosetta. So it could happen. Mm. It's an urgent political film. I wouldn't say it's a very skillful piece of filmmaking. Zan, brief review. There are other films to come, so don't complain if we didn't cover the Palme d'Or winner, because there's still Doug Liman's Fair Game to come. There's still the Rashid Bushareb film, which I think will be the political hot pomme de terre of this festival. But for now, for this far, Zan Brooks, we can read about it more on your brilliant blog, so may I compliment you on the way you've been,
thank you very much,
been typing. Even I haven't managed to keep my eyes open, but you certainly can type it.
That's not writing, that's typing.
www.guardian.co.uk/film is the place for the best coverage of Cannes.
I put a spell on you.
Mathieu Amalric cast quite a spell on the Cannes crowd, particularly the home contingent this year. He's best known to international audiences for his role as the villain in the Bond film Quantum of Solace, and of course as the lead role in The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. And he's fast becoming a national treasure in the mould of Gérard Depardieu and Vincent Cassel. For his latest film, Tournée or On Tour, his actual fourth as director, he also takes on acting duties, starring in A Wandering Tale as a last-chance saloon TV producer, Joachim Zand, who returns from America with a troupe of burlesque dancers in a bid to restore his own fortunes and perhaps repair familial bonds with his sons. I set out to find Cannes's very own one-man ash cloud, Mathieu Amalric, and find out more.
Because you're mine!
Okay. Mathieu Amalric, congratulations on tournée. It looked a lot of fun to make and for you to hang out with all these amazing people.
It's work also, you know. Yeah. You have to write a lot before. We wrote a lot and a lot the script with my two friends, Marcelo and Philippe, so that we could, on the set, try to grab a sense of the present, the moment, the life.
So it looks improvised, but it wasn't.
Great. Great. Oh, no, it wasn't.
That hard work to make it look natural played off.
Yeah.
I wrote in my review of you that I think you're one of the finest smokers on screen. Un maître fumeur de l'écran. Moi.
Oh, thank you.
No, you do it very well, I think, like Belmondo in Abus de Souffle. But the film itself was it's a fantastical idea, I think. No one seems to have done this idea. It reminded me of Fellini, I have to say, in some way, with a lot of breasts.
Mm.
Very cinematic breasts, I think.
Yeah, but it's also for a woman who doesn't have breasts.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's also Julie, she doesn't have breasts. And it's just any body, let's say. And a free body for a free spirit, I don't know, something like that. That's what I found so contagious about their humor, their political sense of, that is said through generosity and shows.
Yeah.
And they're so different. Mm-hmm. They tell different worlds.
Is this burlesque, because it originally it's a French concept and it was very popular in France, is it back to being popular in France? Because in London we have it.
It wasn't popular in France. It's really American invention. And in England.
That's a great celebration. I wondered if you, when you act yourself, and you've worked for some fantastic directors yourself, but when you're actually directing yourself, how do you do it? Yeah. You have to look at the takes and kind of think, oh, no?
No, I don't look at the takes. My girlfriend was there to look at the takes and just say, I don't impress her, so.
But like the burlesque girls who are confident with their body and have to kind of use their bodies to express, is it that for you? Like, you have to take a risk and kind of say, well, I'm going to just perform and have to trust that, that my acting skills are going to work.
It was a good idea, in fact, to act in the film. It wasn't supposed to be like that. It was decided 3 weeks before the shooting. And I could direct from the inside, like they could direct me from the inside, give me tenderness, give me energy, give me hate, give me something, and I would just play with them, you know?
That's where the spontaneity comes from that I said at the top, I think. That's
the spontaneity come from there, and from the precise writing before that I would share with them, tell them exactly what the situation was, what the information we had to give, because I tried to construct a script where you learn things present, you know, and one after the other, in life.
It keeps it interesting for you.
Yeah.
You know the last Bond film, of course, that you starred in, and you know now that they're waiting for the next Bond. They don't know when it's going to happen. Yeah. Have you spoken to Daniel about this
or
the Bond people? Because you're a part of the Bond family now.
Yeah.
What if there's no more Bond?
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, because of Sony and MGM, I don't know, some problem. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. You could be the last Bond villain at this
point. No, don't worry. It's impossible. Barbara Broccoli is too, and Michael G. Wilson are too in love with their mission to continue Bond. No, I don't think so.
Oh, good. Do you think there should be? I think there'll be one year there should be a Bond at Cannes. That would be good. It's never been such a genre kind of thing now. It would be great to be at Cannes.
Yeah.
You should be very proud of being a Bond villain. It's a great club.
Oh, well, you know. I learned a lot about stunts. And, for example, I didn't need to hire a stuntman to do the fight with Damien when he just,
in this film.
And I fall. to fall like that is really, you have to rehearse a lot. And with the guys from the Bond film, I learned that.
Well, there you go. Everything is always a lesson.
Of course, yeah.
Mathieu, absolute pleasure to
Thank
see you.
You,
and félicitations.
Merci
and
beaucoup.
Bon courage avec le film.
Oui, merci. Allez. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Merci indeed to Mathieu Almeric and to all my guests on this Film Weekly, from Cannes to Zam Brooks for his reviews, to, of course, Jim Broadbent, Lindsay Manville and Ruth Sheen from My Ears Another Year, and to Wang Xiaoshai, Xie Xie, for his contribution from Asia. All the sounds of world cinema have been collected for you to reflect what goes on here at Cannes. Well, we will know who wins the Palme d'Or this Sunday night, but till then, enjoy the show. By then, myself, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Fitz, will be back in London, and we cannot leave without saying thank you to the team from Cinema NX and the Isle of Man Film Boat. Those people have given us The Disappearance of Alice Creed recently, and of course me and Orson Welles. Their slate for next year looks equally exciting. Their hospitality this year has been unsurpassed. Here we are, the sun is really setting over the old town in Cannes. I can see the mountains coming into shadowy view. It is definitely time to say au revoir et merci. Do pick up this Sunday's Observer, of course, as I reveal more, and of course give you the legendary Trash Can, the version of Trailer Trash I always do from down here. But until then, it's au revoir, merci beaucoup, and à bientôt.